The following program may contain material that is unsuitable for some audiences. Listener discretion is advised. Aftermath Radio should not be considered a substitute for services provided by a licensed mental health professional. Good afternoon and welcome to Aftermath Radio, brought to you live from the K Beach radio station at Cal State Long Beach.
Let's see how she does here.
I got it.
That was brilliant. Gigi Brar, that was an excellent intro there.
Thank you.
No snags, nothing there. Chantel, you have this worried look on your face.
Because I can't even hear myself think you're yelling.
No, I'm not. I'm
you're yelling into my headphones.
Your headphones might be a little loud.
Down a little bit.
All right. How about that? Better?
Oh, that's me.
There you go.
Oh, it got better.
Yes, a lot better. Thank you.
All right, Dr. Robert Chug, Assistant Professor of Criminal Justice and Forensic Psychology here at Cal State Long Beach. If you'd like to speak with us. Actually, I do sound a little loud, don't I? There we go. You can call us at area code 562-912-3541. That's 562-912-3541. You can Skype us, meaning Chantel Fahmy, at aftermath.radio, where you can actually
chat
with Chant. Very good. You can email us at aftermathradio@kbeach.com. And as always, we encourage you to visit our website, aftermathradio.org. Click on the link in the lower left-hand corner, the radio link, and all of our podcasts are there archived for your listening enjoyment, except for the one that we did 2 weeks ago, which I'm still struggling with.
I was going to say all of them. Is that the truth?
No. No, I'm just going to lay it all out there like it is today. And today we are very happy to have an in-studio guest.
Dun, 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 dun.
And she said she's going
to... Wait.
Dr. Tracy Tolbert, Associate Professorial Lecturer in Criminal Justice, joins us. She's in the house.
Good afternoon, everybody.
Can we hear okay?
Yes, we can.
Okay. Now, can we call you Tracy, or do we have to keep calling you Dr. Tolbert?
No, Tracy's fine.
We can go with Tracy?
Tracy's fine.
All right. Tracy is here for two reasons. First of all, she's going to talk about juvenile psychopathy later on in the show. And plus, we bring Tracy in because it's just kind of fun to have her in here for the whole show because she's literally like three doors down from my office, and we just kind of drag her down here, and she brings a whole different type of energy to the show than we normally get. So it's like really an honor to have you in here.
Always excited.
Yeah. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
And we had an interesting conversation on the way over here, didn't we?
Yes, we did.
I don't know that
yes,
we'll...
About rock and roll and music.
And singing and, being on stage with 10 drunk people in the audience throwing beer bottles and how that...
Yes.
Makes you a better professor.
Yes.
Oh, wait. I need details.
Look at us today. Okay.
Maybe we'll get into that. For me personally, two things that I think I have to get off my chest. First of all, I quit the caffeine 2 days ago.
I thought it was 3 days.
No, this is my third full. So if you round up, I guess it's three.
I hope you last through your night
but
class.
My brain just doesn't work the same way it does as when I'm on caffeine. So there's that. And my hair is unusually spiky today.
Yeah, all I can see
really
is
need a
your hair from my hair.
You can't see anything but
see
my hair over
the
monitor.
Top of your forehead, but that's fine.
All right. So we are actually excited to be back. We have three shows left, including today. And the end of the semester is coming really quick. I guess, what do we want to do Q&A first?
Sure.
All right, let's do that.
Got it right. Oh, do you want the rim shot?
No.
Well,
that's
felt
a joke
like,
rim shot.
I felt like it went there.
Okay, so we got this voicemail this week. Go ahead and play it.
Hello, this is in. I'm calling to inquire about a question I have. I'm 74 years old and have lived 50 years with what I believe is NBD or psychotics. First, my husband of 23 years, and now my children. My question to you is, as a mother, I know the inherent possible dangers of a possible psychotic. my youngest son happens to be a pediatric, and it sort of bothers me. Do I have any moral or legal obligation to make it known that he might possibly have psychotic tendencies, or can I just walk away from the whole mess, which is what my attorney advised me to do? If you could give me a call or let me know, my number is... Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
All right, there you go. So, yeah, we obviously censored out any sort of identifying information there. I picked this voicemail for specific reasons. First of all, it was the only one we got this week, so there's that. Second of all, she mentions that her son is psychotic, and we haven't made the distinction between psychotic and psychopathic on this show in a long time, so I thought this is an excellent segue into that, right? So psychotic, of course, refers to a class of mental disorders called the psychoses, which are generally characterized by either delusions or hallucinations, right? Delusions are false beliefs about things that aren't true, that are maintained in spite of evidence to the contrary. So believing that you're Jesus, or believing that you can fly, or that the FBI is after you, that sort of thing. And then hallucinations are basically sensory perception without sensory input. So you're hearing things like voices that aren't there. You're having visions of things that aren't there, and that sort of thing. So schizophrenia is one of the psychotic disorders. Psychopathy, as we know, is a totally different type of disorder. If a person who is a psychopath has delusions or hallucinations, then they may have psychopathy in addition to something else. But in general, a psychopath would not necessarily be characterized, or would not be characterized by delusions or hallucinations. And there's a few other symptoms that go in there as well. But anyway, now she mentioned a couple of things that I didn't really hear. She said NBDs. Did anyone catch that? What's an NBD? Did you catch that, Tracy?
Multiple personality disorder.
Oh, did she say MPDs?
She said that.
I didn't even.
Okay. But I think the crux of her question was a really fascinating one in terms of morality. So she's a mom. She's got a kid grown son who works in the medical field in a specialization of pediatrics. Apparently he has a history of psychosis or some form of psychotic disorder. And it sounds like she's wondering, should she tell somebody that this guy is out there practicing medicine, basically? And, you know, he has symptoms, or he has a mental disorder that I guess she's assuming could affect his work performance in some way, perhaps even detrimentally. What do you all think?
Well, I think that we need to first ascertain the difference. If she's saying psychotic but meant psychopathy, or if she's saying psychotic and really meant psychotic, because I think that there's a big difference. Don't we talk about all the time how psychopaths can be CEOs and still work completely fine within their fields?
Absolutely. So, good point.
That's my take.
I agree with Chant.
Tracy, what do you think?
Yeah, I think another thing is that, though, but we don't know what his behavioral patterns are. She's saying this, okay? Mm-hmm. And so there's a missing body of data here that makes it very difficult to make any kind of analysis.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's missing.
I mean, it wouldn't, if she's listening, I don't mean to offend her, but how do we know that she's, you know, not misperceiving things, or, you know, but that being said, if we accept everything she says on face value, I think she sounds like she's been to an attorney already. Mm-hmm. I guess my immediate answer is I don't know. I mean, I think if she's seeing signs of potential violence or something that's sort of dangerous, that she certainly could report it to. He must be working under some sort of license, and so the licensing agency probably would be the place to go. The thing about schizophrenia and other psychotic disorders is, depending on how severe they are and the individual, they can be managed quite well with medications. I mean, people can live reasonable lives, perhaps even as sort of a pediatric specialist, you know, if they're taking their medications. That's the problem. Typically, the problems we see with these folks are when they go off their medications for whatever reason. They think that they don't need them, and that's when the symptoms start creeping back in. So I think my advice to you, a caller, would be, it sounds like you've sought legal advice, and I always do respect the opinions of attorneys. So I think if your attorney has given you that advice, I certainly respect that. If you feel some sort of tugging morally on your heart, then you could perhaps contact the licensing agency, maybe anonymously, and just sort of ask, you know, well, what if I had this information on so-and-so, and would that be important to you? Again, understanding that it probably relates more so to how his symptoms are being managed now by medication rather than the fact that he's been diagnosed by something previously in his history. That's my take.
Can I comment on that?
Absolutely. Okay.
Yeah, I think, too, that another issue here is the issue of morality. She's asking whether or not it is a moral imperative that she report this.
Mm-hmm.
And so I understand that, you know, the whole issue of morality, you know, is sort of paradoxical in nature. You know, it's relative to, you know, time, space, context, et cetera, et cetera. But it really relates to intervention and prevention, not so much morality. But if something is happening and someone is at danger, you know, from being treated by her son, that they might be harmed, well, then it's not so much a matter of just morality, but that intervention must take place. Prevention has to take place. Mm-hmm. It has to be something that we are all very concerned with to allay the outcome of a possible destructive diagnosis or treatment, for that matter.
Yeah.
So once again, though, but without the actual data, we don't know exactly what's going on here. But nevertheless, though, I think there should be some attention given to the idea that intervention is necessary when you do see things happening.
Something obvious in front of you.
Yes.
Right.
Excellent.
Excellent, excellent point. And I would say, caller, if you'd like to call with more information, maybe we can help you out. Or if you even want to call in and talk to us on the air, I mean, we could do that too. But that was a great question, and thank you for that. Okay, I got an email. You got the email soundbite?
Oh, another Q&A email?
Yeah.
Oh, I would. Okay.
Got mail.
All right, so this email refers to the Twitter. Mm-mm. Now, have we tweeted yet this show?
No, why are you looking at me?
I can't log into this computer.
You know, we're supposed to be doing Twitter and Facebook. And now Chantal is like feverishly logging into whatever she needs to do. No, but I got some really good advice from a listener on tweeting and Facebook and some podcast stuff.
Something's wrong with Twitter.com.
Oh, so it's not us. That's a scary-looking monster or whatever it is.
Something is technically wrong.
Okay, so check this out. Just some advice. This is more so for my Aftermath Radio production crew, but the rest of you might be interested in this as well, too. So hello, Dr. Shug. I appreciate the work you're doing with Aftermath Radio. I notice your team has started a Twitter presence at Aftermath Radio. If I may make some suggestions to your use of Twitter is more effective. In Twitter, making a habit of clicking at connect at the top of the screen at least once a day, that's where people are contacting you on Twitter. And during the show, you'll want to check that as well as your Twitter feed for questions and comments. So are we doing that?
I don't even
know. Yeah, as long as we're logged in, we're seeing them as
okay.
we come through.
But like even on our days off? Here's second point. Give some advance notice on Twitter of an upcoming guest, like say a few days before the show. I think that's actually a really good idea.
Yeah, which we did do for Dr. Hare and Dr. Leadham.
Good job, guys. Let's keep it up then. Currently, your Twitter notices are sent right before and during the show, which doesn't offer much time to become aware and respond. For example, listen to the show. This is especially important since the show isn't on regularly every week. And that's sort of my bad. The inconsistency of the schedule this semester is really my fault, without going into much detail. All right. And then how about starting to follow some of your mental health colleagues, organizations, and others on Twitter? That's another thing, too, right? The Twitter is sort of a network, right? So the more people we follow, kind of the more in-your-face we get all across the board. Is that how it works?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Dr. Tolbert, do you have a Twitter?
Actually, I do.
Okay, well, we will be following you and expect
you.
To follow
you can follow
back.
Us.
Well, the thing is, though, I just got it.
Okay.
And because I felt compelled. But I'm still trying to figure it out.
We are too.
It's a novice tweeter. Hey, we got to go to a break.
Yes.
We'll come back and we'll pick up with this email. Aftermath Radio, we'll be right back after this here on K-Beach.
Hi, my name is Bob, and I'm a psychopath.
Hi, Bob!
Bob!
Do you know what a psychopath is? Do you have one in your life? How would you know? Join Dr. Robert Shug Mondays at 4 p.m. for Aftermath Radio and get the facts about psychopathy.
Aftermath Radio.
Aftermath Radio. Please do call us. Area code 562-912-3541. That's 562-912-3541. Skype us at aftermath.radio. Email us at aftermathradio@kbeach.com. And as always, visit our website, aftermathradio.org. Click on the radio link in the lower left-hand corner to have access to all of our podcasts, except for the one from 2 weeks ago. And actually, as a bonus today, we have Dr. Tracy Tolbert, Associate Professorial Lecturer in Criminal Justice, in studio, hanging out with the Aftermath Radio crew.
It's a blast.
She's keeping it real, is what she's doing. That's her job today, just to keep it real. And so we are halfway through, actually three-quarters of the way through Aftermath Radio Q&A.
Oh.
That would be Aftermath Radio Q&A.
Ring, no ring.
This is an email.
Yeah. Oh. Why am I... Aftermath Radio
Q&A. You got mail.
Great. So this is actually about Twitter, and this is something that the management has told us to stay on top of, and maybe we've been a little lax. I don't know. Or maybe we haven't embraced the Twitter like we really should.
Yeah, and it's because none of us had one already, and none of us really like knew how to...
Navigate tweet
around
yeah.
it. It's actually confusing. It's not as simple as Facebook.
This is your generation, guys. You should like have this down. You know what I mean? Dr. Tolbert and I have an excuse, right?
She has one.
So bottom line, what is your
wow.
excuse?
Way to throw me under the bus.
Well, I didn't say anything.
You don't have a Facebook either.
I don't.
And that's,
well,
that's even a little bit more your scene, if you
my will. Scene? Like sort of
age.
At least a decade ago? Is that?
Yeah.
Yeah. I just feel like, you know, there's, you know, things that should be private, I guess, and
you
I just worry about
it.
Yeah, but then what's the point of having it if you can't put pictures of, like, you know, a drunken New Year's Eve party from...
You send those via email to your friends.
Is that right? Actually, nothing should go out electronically anywhere, right? Because it's going to come back to someday.
That's a doctor.
Who knows? Maybe
I want to
run for president one day, right? And then all my Facebook images come up.
Right.
But then again, all these podcasts will be floating around in the cloud, so to speak. And so everything that I've said, you know, over the past year and a half will be available to be critiqued by the media. I won't be running for president anytime soon, that's for sure.
I'm glad we got you, Dan.
Right. Anyway, so emailer, good tips about Twitter. Here's another one. Your team should try to tweet something at least once a day. It could be a tip, a thought for the day, a link to an important article or web posting, some upcoming event. Or if you have a Facebook presence, something from that.
I definitely think that we should do a thought for the day. I think that's a really, really good idea
every day. You know what I like about that is not only is it, we don't necessarily have to come up with something like earth-shattering, right? Monumental. But it sort of reminds people that we're here,
right.
You know?
Thank you for that tip.
Well, there's more. And it says...
They're going to go on and say it's mandatory.
we can get our... apparently, our podcasts are available in iTunes already. They are. And it's at this place called podbean.com. So if you go to aftermathradio.podbean.com/feed, you can actually it comes up like in an iTunes window, and you can, that's where you download the podcast. Remember was it with you guys?
Yeah.
We were having a controversy. How do we download the podcast?
I remember Podbean, but there was no place to download on the.
Well, this listener, and thank you for sending this so much, sent me the link. And it's that's what it is. It's aftermathradio.podbean.com/feed. And when you go there, that our podcasts come up in an iTunes window.
Do you think that's something Brian did, or are they the recent ones?
No, because I know we use the Podbean to host the podcast for the show, but apparently somehow it makes
They're
it available
linked.
For yeah.
Very cool.
You see how
that's
that
cool.
is?
And there you go, listeners.
And that was for Empathy for All sent us that. So we appreciate that.
Thank you.
Yeah. Any comments? I know you're getting ready to turn it on.
Well, what I want to say about that is that I think that the new social networking outlets or mediums are extremely important today. I mean, after all, it is the age of technology. You know, we are embracing that now, and everybody links into these mediums. I, for one, was reluctant to do Facebook or anything because I'm sort of like, you know, you on this. I don't want anybody to know my business. I'm not going to post any weird pictures on there or anything of that nature. But at the same time, though, I went and got a Facebook page.
Mm-hmm.
And every now and then I'll go on it to see what's happening.
What's on your Facebook page now, Tracy?
Nothing, just
a blank page.
A picture of me and,
See, I don't trust those people.
Some of my likes. Yeah. Music that I like. Stuff
I
like that.
See. All right.
And every now and then I'll make a comment, but I'm the kind of person, I don't feel like, you know, saying anything unless I have something to say.
Okay.
You know, and so I'm not going to comment, you know, continuously, you know, my, you know, dog just got out, you know, or I'm getting ready to go to the store now.
Going to the gym.
Like. Yeah, right. You know, I'm bored or whatever. I just feel like when I have something to say, but I do understand the importance of it.
Okay.
And even Twitter, for that matter, even more so, I was definitely reluctant to do that. But then one day I was sitting in the office and I thought, you know, I have to have a Twitter account. I got to see what's going on. All this information is out there and I'm not privy to it. Yeah. And I need to be. And so I did. I got a Twitter account and I'm going to figure out how to use it, you know, what links I want to follow and what do I want to say, because I do think it's an important medium of communication, you know, getting the message out. So for Aftermath Radio, I think it's significant. I think the person who texts or who emailed that definitely is onto something.
See, the problem with Dr. Tolbert and I have is we're what's considered OG.
Yeah.
Right? We're original gangsta.
Original gangsta.
And there was really no room for Twitter or Facebook.
Yeah.
Maybe she is.
Yeah.
I can't be OG.
We just sort of.
I know you say that often, but
we just sort of got in your face. With all this.
I have a question.
Yes.
So I'm just thinking about social networking, and I don't know or I don't remember if we've talked about this. And I know, as far as psychopathy is concerned, to diagnose somebody via social networking and how, you know, I know that you need to have more background information than just how they behave or interact on social networking sites. So I can see that obviously being an issue. But do you think that there's any way to...
I mean, that's a really good... If you don't mind me cutting you off. And
oh, no.
You know, diagnosing someone with psychopathy or psychopathic traits over some sort of social... network vehicle, I would say, you know, the problem we always run into is, like we've talked about before, is getting enough information about different areas of a person's life to really make a good assessment. Mm-hmm. You know, so how they may act at work might be different from how they act with their family, how they act with their friends. And social media, I think, provides, you know, there's two problems I see here. Social media might not provide us with enough information about sort of multiple areas of the person's life, you know, that we would expect to see psychopathic traits permeate. Plus, we don't really know if the persona that they're putting forth on the internet is really their true
self. That's what I was going to ask you. What if they're narcissistic online and not in person?
That being said, I mean, you hear instances all the time of people sort of like cyber stalking or cyber bullying. So people's own personality come out, I think, through the internet. I also feel the same way about like driving, like the way people drive. I think personality characteristics come out. These are among the things I know, but I can't prove, right? But people's aspects of people's personality come out through their driving, whether you cut people off or if you signal every time or if you're very polite, right? And I think the same thing is with these internet chat rooms and whatnot. I think we can see a glimpse into their personalities, but I don't know if there's enough information there. However, if maybe over time, over multiple posts or entries or whatever these are called, you can start to see patterns of manipulation, if you will, charm. I don't know. But again, it's just having enough data, and it would still only be limited to that specific setting.
Yeah,
so
interesting.
But that being said, we see more and more studies coming to bear now in the literature on social networking and its effects on this, that, or the other, right? And so I would expect probably sometime within the next maybe 5-10 years, some sort of social networking study on psychopathy. You know, I don't know who's going to do it, but maybe someone would be able to find sort of a valid way of getting at psychopathic traits using that. I mean, I think it'd be a great... I mean, that's where we're headed, right?
Yeah.
That's if we're all becoming sort of connected and online, if that's where our lives are, then it would be good to know, because we don't want to be manipulated and violated and kind of, you know, controlled on the internet, because that's no fun either.
No.
And Tracy's dying to say something. I can just see it. I'm in peripheral vision.
How can you tell?
She's
posturing.
Yeah.
No, the segue from what you're saying, I think that's absolutely true. The whole medium of social networking in of itself has created entirely new identities, new characteristics of identity, consciousness, perception, et cetera, et cetera. And in this, behavioral patterns have shifted too. So I think one of the most obvious things that we've seen is behavioral patterns shift. Like, for example, cyberbullying versus physical real-world bullying.
Plug my thesis.
Okay, there you go. See? The difference is, though, that when someone's physically bullying you, you know, you can do something about that, you know, if you know what to do and how to do it. However, this individual that's online bullying you, well, see, they can be aggressive in so many different ways. And so the definition of aggression changes in that respect. And so the whole definition of the psychopathy itself changes also. And so I think as we move more and more into 21st century academics with regard to technology and its effect on individuality and behavior, well, then I think that itself is going to open up a whole new vanguard mm-hmm. of research in new behavioral patterns that are not consistent with 20th century definitions of behavior.
Mm-hmm.
We've already seen it in terms of criminal behavior, certain types of behavior, but I think it's going to expand into a much bigger body of work as well. And that will be interesting.
And that degree, the anonymity involved yes. in cyberbullying. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
It really does free you up to be kind of a jerk, to be honest. I mean, that's what the same thing with road rage. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. There's a certain level of anonymity involved in being inside a car. And so you can kind of be a jerk and where you wouldn't necessarily walk up to someone, mm-hmm. you know, face to face and do it. Mm-hmm. The internet's the same way. I think it does have the capacity to bring out the worst in people just because it can be unfiltered. And there's no mm-hmm. real consequences directly in the moment, face to face.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. I have a personal license plate, so I don't, even if I would be the type of person that's road rage-esque, which I'm not.
Right. Oh, I don't see that.
Yeah. I'm still very careful. I can't tell you how often I get a text, I see you on the freeway.
Really?
Well, because my license plate says Chan.
Now the whole world knows that.
That's fine. They don't know how it's spelled.
Yeah, because there's so many variations in that spelling. Yeah, so if you have a vanity license plate, road rage probably would not be.
I always used to think about that too. I'm like, why would you get a personalized license plate? What if something were to happen and you get so easily caught? But your side is that you wouldn't do anything.
Who's text messaging you while you're driving on the freeway saying they see you on the freeway?
People that know me.
And then why are you looking at your phone while you're driving on the freeway?
I don't know what you're talking about.
All right. Let's go to break.
All my texts after.
Aftermath Radio. We'll be right back after this here on K-Beach.
Hi, my name is Bob, and I'm a psychopath.
Hi, Bob!
Do you know what a psychopath is? Do you have one in your life? How would you know? Join Dr. Robert Shugg Mondays at 4 p.m. for Aftermath Radio and get the facts about psychopathy.
We are back. Aftermath Radio. Dr. Robert Shugg, Assistant Professor of Criminal Justice and Forensic Psychology here at Long Beach State on Aftermath Radio, where we talk about all things psychopathic. If you'd like to speak with us, please call us, area code 562-912-3541. That's 562-912-3541. Skype us at aftermath.radio, email us at aftermathradio@kbeach.com, and visit our website at aftermathradio.org. Now, we have had for the past half hour our special guest, in-studio guest, Dr. Tracy Tolbert, Associate Professorial Lecturer in Criminal Justice. And Dr. Tolba's area of expertise, I'm just reading off your website now, if that's okay.
Yeah.
Is that fine?
Yeah.
All right.
It's almost accurate.
It's almost accurate, is it? Dr. Tolba's area of expertise include criminology, sex, and gender. She's particularly interested in exploring the facilitators and barriers affecting the way women report sex crimes related to various forms of predatory criminal behavior and victim-survivor response patterns. There's actually a lot of overlap of what you do. Research-wise, with what Aftermath
yes.
does, really, and there's like you're really actually an untapped resource. We need to
Absolutely.
We need to take advantage of you more often. I think I'm actually going to turn the mic this way.
Yeah, I agree. Actually, I think about this a lot.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Anyway, but today, and you and I have been, I've been sort of harassing you for the past probably month and a half to get you back on here because it always is such a pleasure having you in here. And you suggested the topic of juvenile psychopathy,
yes.
and I thought that would be a really good topic.
Yes.
So, I guess you had a very kind of interesting and compelling moment in your former career.
Yeah.
That kind of brings this to bear now. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, sure. This issue of juvenile psychopathy, of course, I mean, I teach juvenile delinquency in this department also, but I remember one lecture that I gave earlier in the semester actually was developed based on this memory that I have when I was a law enforcement officer, police officer in the Midwest prior to graduate school. And this was in the late 80s or maybe 1990. But one night we got a radio call that there was a break-in in progress at one of the neighborhood centers in the area that I worked. And so, you know, that wasn't an unusual occurrence. I mean, it happened quite often because there are, you know, equipment inside and that sort of thing. And so, you know, juveniles and sometimes adults would break in, you know, for, you know, to sell the goods for money. Mm-hmm. This particular time, well, we all responded, you know, several cars at once, including myself, in our usual tactical fashion. And as we exited the cars, the actual break-in was in progress, and so we sort of, you know, took off in different directions, chasing after, you know, would-be suspects. I was chasing this one kid. It appeared to be a young man around 13, 14 years old, around the corner of the building. And so it's you know, it's sort of dark out, but there's enough light where, you know, you can see where you're going. And so this kid darted around the corner of the building, and then I came around the corner right after him. And when I turned the corner, I was staring right into the face of a handgun, 38 Special. And at that moment, I couldn't register the significance of it because I was in full flight. And so I just bowled him over really quick, put him down on the ground, got the gun from him, you know, handcuffed him, and then, you know, went back to, you know, our procedure. Didn't think about it that much until after we were going through the process of getting these kids booked. I thought about it. Usually the adrenaline, once it hits and then it dissipates in the aftermath of an event like that, then you begin to think about what just happened and the danger that, you know, that you could have been in, which was, for me, was that he could have shot me.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was, like, no more than 2 or 3 feet away from me, he could have shot me. And the question was, why didn't he fire? And even though I was wearing a vest at the time, the impact of the 38 bullet would have knocked me down at close range like that, although it might not have torn through the Kevlar, but nevertheless, though, it would have given me quite a bruise. On the other hand, though, he was close enough to hit me in the neck or underneath my armpit or right directly in the face, which would have been fatal.
Yeah, it sure would.
And so the question for me, after as I thought about it, was why didn't he shoot? And he's got a gun.
Mm-hmm.
He had a gun. And so this is like 1989, 1990, and in the Midwest, we didn't have Crip-style gangs or blood-style gangs yet.
Mm-hmm.
They were growing and evolving, but they hadn't got to that point yet where a 13-year-old, 14-year-old would actually shoot a police officer, but nevertheless, he had the instrument. And later, as the years went by, after I, you know, left that field and went into graduate school, that incident stayed with me. And so I was mentioning it to Robert, Dr. Shook here, you know, about talking about this on the show with regard then to the issue of juvenile psychopathy, because what I saw in hindsight was the development, or I should say the evolution, of a whole new behavioral pattern related to juvenile delinquency.
Mm-hmm.
And it relates more to what we now designate as juvenile psychopathy. What has happened? That we come to the point where juveniles now are reflecting the same psychopathic behavioral patterns of adults, whereby now they will shoot you without any moral consciousness for whatever abstract definitions they're using, you know, for the cause of doing such things. And we see it play out day after day after day after day across cities, across this country. And it's rising to the level of a serious epidemic, at
right.
least I believe.
And let me jump in here for a second. That's a fantastic story. And so why we really like having Dr. Tolbert in here is she comes from more of the criminological, sociological perspective paradigm. So it's really nice to bounce ideas off of her, because I know me personally, I'm so used to thinking it as of these issues as a psychologist. and as a neuroscientist, right? Mm-hmm. Where you come at it from a much different angle, but there's so much overlap. Yes. And psychologists generally speaking don't like to talk about juvenile psychopaths because mm-hmm. they feel really hesitant, uneasy, scared, I don't know, of the implications of putting a label on a kid that young that could potentially impact their lives negatively, you know, from then on. So what typically psychologists do is they talk about kind of downward extensions of psychopathy, as we understand it, as it's defined in adults, right? But really, I mean, I think from the psychological point of view, a lot of the focus has been, well, how do we diagnose psychopathy in youth, and should we be doing it, right? Mm-hmm. So that's kind of where my discipline lies with this. Now you, and we've got a sort of a whole laundry list of stuff to talk about here. So where do you see, you know, from your perspective, this kind of relationship between psychopathy and juveniles starting, or where's the evidence, or where do you...
Well, we see it in certain incidents, like, for example, the Columbine incident, for example, was a watershed event in terms of juvenile behavior. Now, it's not the first time, though. Of course, this is when Dylan Klebold and Eric Harris, two young men, went into Columbine High School. I think it was in 93, maybe a little bit later than that, and they shot the school up that day, and then they killed themselves. And in the aftermath of that horrific event, I mean, it wasn't the first time, but it was the first time that the media really picked up on it and ran with it as a major story, an international story. And it raised many questions about the state of youth in America and where we were at and how did we miss this. And so you had the typical political responses, religious responses, even in terms of educators, you know, that blamed Hollywood, blamed rap music, and all that sort of thing. And I thought these linear answers, you know, to this problem is endemic of where we stand right now with regard to understanding what juvenile delinquency actually is. Something has happened. Don't know what it is exactly. Something has happened, though, where juvenile behavioral patterns have manifested way past, you know, the status offenses that we defined them with, you know, for the 20th century under utilitarian reform, and now into something more disparate. We remand more and more juveniles into the criminal justice system today because the juvenile justice system is not prepared to deal with the reality of their behavior. And that's symptomatic of what's going on.
Right.
Okay? That's where the evidence lies. The fact that, well, they're not acting like juveniles anymore. And even though those definitions are complicated, you know, in a sense of what really constitutes that, but the fact of the matter is that youth today, seriously, are in a state of risk.
Yeah.
Period. Period. And so while you would characterize, in terms of 20th century defining structures, what a juvenile is in terms of a person who's truant and who's, you know, who might, you know, assault someone, who might, you know, run away from home. But now we're in an entirely different ballgame here where we have young men and women in gangs and in other instances who are using serious firearms and weaponry. And in the past, when I have talked to them and asked them questions like, well, why did you do that? Why did you shoot the whole place up when you went in to shoot one person and you shot the mother and you shot the kids? You know, why did you do that? And a kid sits back and looks at you with a cold-blooded stare and tells you, well, everybody got to die sometime. See, now that's not a kid.
Yeah, that's...
That's a person who's exhibiting adult-like psychopathy.
I'd have to agree with you there. Yeah. And I know we're coming up on a commercial break here pretty quick, but it does seem to be that. And plus, I was thinking of a couple of things. Another thing is these young gang members know that they won't be doing any real prison time. I mean, they definitely will be out by the time I think they're
21.
Right. Yeah, and so there you go, ready to start over.
Right. And that's in some states, and therein lies the rub with the juvenile justice system. The criminal justice system is now charged with the responsibility of trying to adjudicate this And these kids are like 13, 14, 15 years old. We have kids serving life in prison right now. Kids.
Yeah.
Okay, who are like 16, 17 now, but they were 12, 13 when they committed the capital crime.
Right.
See? And so the whole fabric of our system is changing, but we're struggling to define what's happening.
Yeah, and I think in my work I've come across folks who have done pretty horrible things at young ages, and I'm often stricken by the sort of response from folks who maybe have not had exposure to it on the front line like you have and sort of I have in a sense. And how could you punish or put a 13-year-old through the criminal justice system? They're just a 13-year-old boy. And I know every story is different, and certainly I'm sure there are many cases where that might not be appropriate. But the fact of the matter is that there are cases where it certainly is appropriate, and we're just not equipped to deal with it. I think our mindset, you know, as a humanity or as a public, if you will, is not ready to accept the fact that there are very young people who can do some very, for lack of a better word, evil things.
Yes,
you know?
Absolutely. I agree.
We got to go break?
No, I just wanted to say something. We've actually been talking a lot in our policy class about public furor and moral panic and how this contributes not only to policy, but in, I'm just thinking about, you know, Columbine shooting, and a lot of it has to do with the fear that gets instilled in the public. I don't know. It just reminds me of that.
No, I think you're right. I mean, it's a fear that demands action from the criminal justice system, from law enforcement. But that fear is I don't know, the defining structure of that fear itself is abstract, and it's off the chart because people don't know what's happening. People don't know what they're looking at. And like you were saying, Robert, you know, we still want to define juveniles, as young people, you know, who do things that are insignificant and transitory and all that sort of thing, and they will grow out of it. But this is not the same.
Right. Let me hold that thought. We got to take a break. We'll be right back after this. Aftermath Radio here on K-Beach.
Hi, my name is Bob, and I'm a psychopath.
Hi, Bob!
Bob!
Do you know what a psychopath is? Do you have one in your life? How would you know? Join Dr. Robert Shug Mondays at 4 p.m. for Aftermath Radio and get the facts about psychopathy.
Aftermath Radio, we're back. Dr. Robert Shug, Assistant Professor of Criminal Justice and Forensic Psychology here at Cal State University, Long Beach. If you'd like to talk to us, 562-912-3541, 562-912-3541. Skype us at aftermath.radio, email us at aftermathradio@kbeach.com, and go visit the website. All right, and we have in studio Dr. Tracy Tolbert, Associate Professorial Lecturer in Criminal Justice. We're here talking about juvenile psychopathy. It's a pretty heated discussion. And left off kind of talking about some of these really more extreme behaviors that we're starting to see in certain segments of the juvenile offender population, and kind of the dangers or the hesitations, or I don't know, however you want to put it, in even using the term juvenile psychopathy, but with the understanding that, wow, there are some kids out there that, something needs to be done, and we don't seem to be equipped to handle it. Now, you kind of wanted to move into causes and then eventually in terms of intervention. So I'll let you take the lead then.
Well, yeah, I think that it's important, you know, while we discuss this and to, you know, in one sense lament, you know, the outcomes of their behavioral patterns and that sort of thing. But, you know, and so we study the effect on a widespread basis in the academy here. But I think it's important also to focus more attention on what causes this to happen, okay? Is there a similarity in the research that links, you know, variables like child abuse, early alcoholism, drug abuse, you know, neglect, family dysfunction, et cetera, et cetera, to adult psychopathy? Is it possible then that you can see this evolving over time in a young person and then find standpoints by which we can intervene and prevent it continuing? You know, like, for instance, there's that, you know, well-worn generalization that, and I don't know who presented it, but I'm sure you guys will recognize it, that there are three principal characteristics to recognize an antisocial youth, and that is one, that they wet the bed, you know, beyond
the homicidal triad.
Right, exactly. They kill the family dog or something, okay, just to see how long it would take to die. They also are fire starters,
right,
that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, those are rather obvious signs that something might be wrong and that the child might need help.
Right.
But is it that obvious, or are there other, you know, more benign behavioral patterns that relate to childhood aggression, you know, significant forms of aggression, anger, refusal to obey, you know, the codes of the family or whatever it is, you know, that also could, you know, invite prevention and intervention? Because I think it's important we go there with this. We have to start finding a way to do this.
Right. And just to address your first, I think, sort of question there in terms of looking at factors such as parental abuse and neglect and parental incarceration and all these things, there have been studies that have linked that to, you know, antisocial features and psychopathic traits and whatnot. So, yes, I mean, I think, you know, in wondering if are the signs there before you get full-blown adult psychopath, or even if we want to say, if we can say full-blown juvenile psychopath, I mean, understanding that there's limitations to saying that, I would have to say absolutely. This is not something that is created in a vacuum overnight, right? Typically not.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I'm definitely a devotee of the theory that nothing happens in a vacuum, particularly with regard to criminal behavior of this type, of this magnitude, that there's always a series of events, situations, and circumstances that come together in time and space. They form temporal relationships where we can see them forming. And if we can know what those characteristics are, meaning that if we can concentrate research, a reality-based research, on studying what those characteristics might be as they occur, and then post some kind of model whereby, you know, we can see them, step in at the right time, and redirect the kid into behavioral patterns. I don't want to say modification, but behavioral patterns of consciousness and identity that will reshape then their outcome. I mean, so my question in that sense is that possible? Can we actually do something like that? Because, you know, I see, and I'm sure we all see the news, you know, where a parent is yelling and screaming about, you know, my kid would never do anything like that. It's the police, you know, said, you know. And I look at that, and I'm just mystified, because I want to say to this person, yeah, you did. You knew. You knew what this kid was about.
Right.
You either helped shape this kid. And you're denying responsibility, you know, as the parents of Dylan Klebold and Eric Harris did in shaping this, you know, or that, you know, you just don't know what you're looking at. We don't know what we're looking at.
Right. I think when it comes to parenting, and this is also it's a very touchy issue, because I do believe that there are actually parents out there that are probably at their wit's end and just feel very helpless and have really tried everything they possibly could to help this kid out, and everything they've tried has failed. And I have a lot of respect for those types of parents. But then I think, like you sort of hit on, there's this other type of parent who is either in denial with their head kind of buried in the sand, or is in this more of sort of more of like an active denial, where they literally see it sort of happening in front of them probably on a regular basis, and they tell themselves, oh, well, that's, like you say, make excuses for it.
I mean, I don't know if that characteristic of the 21st century, you know, the need to work and all this kind of stuff also, you know, affecting that, meaning that lack of ability for parents to see. But I, you know, one thing that I tell my classes all the time, we kind of laugh about it, but it's true. How many times when you were a teenager or a juvenile, when you came home from school and recognize somebody's been in your room? Your mother has been in your room, looking in your secret places for stuff because she knew they were there, or she's found something and sitting at the kitchen table waiting on you when you get home to explain, what are you doing with this joint or whatever, you know, and you're pissed, you know, but that's what a parent does.
Right.
It's parents' responsibility to know what their child are doing, you see? And so I do see that more and more. And I don't want to make generalizations about parenting in, you know, in general, in that sense. I think that there are overwhelmingly good parents out there struggling to raise their kids, right? Overwhelmingly populations of good kids out there.
Right.
But it's that unique statistic that causes so much mayhem.
Yep. And that's what gets publicized.
Yes.
And right. And just for the record, my mother never went through my room, but I never gave her a reason to.
Oh, you're so cool. Such
and,
a butt. You're so good.
And on a related note, I drove up to drop my son off, who is in his early teen years, at school. And on April 20th, 4/20, which is the big sort of marijuana awareness day, right? And I was approached by this guy. He was actually in this kind of like ambulance-like uniform, and he gave me a home drug testing kit, gave it to me and said, use this as a conversation starter with your son. So, yeah, I ended up using it on myself. I wanted to make sure that I wasn't testing dirty for anything. No, I'm kidding. Okay, so we got, 2 minutes left? Did you say? Where do you want to go with this for 2 minutes?
Let's just be cognizant, of this as an issue, as a problem. It's something that needs to be discussed, I think. And so, and there are no easy answers here. I'm not raising it as to say, I've got the answer to it, or anyone does for that matter. It's just that it is an issue, and it needs to be dealt with. We can't hide, in the sand about this because it will evolve more and more. We're talking about, if you looked at the studies of the 1990s about juvenile crime, violent crime, and how it increased, from 1960s to the 90s, there's a 169% increase for various reasons, drug sales, gun use, et cetera, et cetera. But that's the 90s. Now it's 2012.
Right.
What are the statistics now? And I've got some startling statistics here. I'm not going to get into them now, but if anyone wanted to see this, I'd be glad to send it to them. But these statistics are startling with regard to the numbers of violent crimes that juveniles are committing. So I just think then we have to have this discussion.
Okay. And actually, we're running close to being out of time here. If folks wanted to email you, can they get a hold of you from the email contact on the website?
Yes,
tracy.tolbert@cslb.edu?
Absolutely.
Great. And are you going to come back again sometime soon?
Absolutely.
Excellent.
Please do.
It's always a pleasure.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for being here. Next week, we have Dr. Mary Ellen O'Toole coming on talking about criminal profiling and psychopathy. And then in 2 weeks, we have the Wheel of Controversy. So it's a very busy, very exciting end of the season. Thanks for joining us again. You can reach us during the week at 562-912-3541. That's 562-912-3541. Or Skype us at aftermath.radio. Email us at aftermathradio@kbeach.com. Dr. Robert Shug for Aftermath Radio signing off. We'll see you next week here on KBeach.
You've been listening to Aftermath Radio, production of the KBeach radio station at California State University, Long Beach. Produced in association with AftermathSurvivingPsychopathy.org. Your host has been Dr. Robert Shug. Your producers have been Brian Frederick, Chantel Fahmy, and Gurjeet Brar. Join us next Monday at 4 p.m. for another exciting episode. If you or someone you know has been victimized and you'd like to talk to someone, call the Cal State Long Beach Counseling and Psychological Services number at 562-985-4001. Aftermath Radio.